Hello, yes. Very good. So welcome to this afternoon session. We can have a couple of questions first and then do some meditation. Okay.
This is a good one, actually. Poor lady. It's not that one. Wait a minute.
Sorry. It's not poor lady.
It says, my roommate snores very loudly, so I can't meditate in the mornings, even using earplugs. Should I learn to tolerate the noise, or should I find a new roommate?
One of the monks, Bodhidharma Monastery, his brother was visiting from Europe. There's no space for anything over there. Even if the most holiest person in the world came to Bodhidharma Monastery, he wouldn't be able to find a space for them. So I said, well, there's no place for him to stay, your brother. He said, we grew up together. We can stay in the same room. I said, look at your age. How old is your brother? Guaranteed, both of you will snore. But he said, my brother is, I know him very well. I think I can handle that. I said, well, what's your plan? My plan is, I'll make sure I go to sleep first. Then my snoring will keep my brother awake. But anyway, I said, okay, well, you know, it's up to you. So his brother came, and sure enough, sharing a small room together with his brother fell asleep first and started to snore. That's a really small room in the monk's huts. So he started to snore. So he thought, oh my goodness, he didn't realize how loud his brother was when he was snoring. And so what he did was, first of all, he just was meditating, and then he remembered Ajahn Chah's teaching, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. So what could he mean? So instead of disturbing the noise, instead of being negative to it, it was happening, he couldn't escape from it, so he made that the focus of his meditation, as I mentioned just before we had our lunch break. It's there, it's important, so you care for it. So he started changing his attitude towards his brother's snoring from something he was trying to escape from, adding all this negativity to it, until he started to notice his brother's snoring had a rhythm to it. It had a beat. And it was a type of music which he had never ever heard before. And being a European, he started to imagine this was some really avant-garde music, just without too much structure, but with a rhythm, with a beat. And it was breaking the boundaries of what we think is musical composition, like many great musicians and have done before. And so after a while, just changing his perception of the snoring soon became, he said the last thing he remembered when he woke up in the morning was just how beautiful that snoring was, and how melodious, and how he could see the amazing qualities which no musician had ever seen before. He had a nice night's sleep. He changed his perception of the snoring from something which was really negative, which kept him awake, to something which was beautiful and melodious. Wonderful way of doing it. So that's what to do with your roommate. Just change the snoring to something very melodious and beautiful. If that doesn't work, plan B is make sure you go to sleep first. But we all snore. Once when I was doing a meditation a day in a prison, because it was a high security prison, I had to have a prison officer with me at all times. So he had to join in with the meditation session. There's only about 7 or 8 prisoners in there. And as we said, close your eyes, you know, watch your breath. And after about 5 minutes, I heard somebody snoring. It wasn't me. It wasn't one of the prisoners. It was a prison officer that brought us to sleep. And as I opened my eyes, one of the prisoners, his hand was about that far away from the officer's keys. And eyes over my eyes, I gave him a dirty look. He said, oh, I jumped up. One more, about 10 more seconds, I'd have got those keys. But out of respect for me, he put his hand away. So, anyway, the snoring sometimes happens. If it does happen, just make that the object of your meditation. It's the most prominent thing. You can't avoid it. So, now's the most important time. What's in front of you is the most important thing in the world. And have this wonderful caring for it, embracing it. So embrace the snoring. Don't embrace the partner's neck. But embrace the noise and the care. Yes?
Venerable Bhante, can you please explain about Vipassana meditation and also to compare it with, make a comment about the difference with Samatha?
I'm not saying speak to the hand. That's really gross. Ajahn Chah will put his hand up like this, and he said, that's Samatha. He said, that's Vipassana. Now you can see Vipassana, you can't see Samatha. Now you can see Samatha, now you can't see Vipassana. They always go together. You can't have one without the other. So, because of that, that's what Ajahn Chah used to say. My simile is, there were these two meditators in Australia. Guy, their partners, Sam and Vi. And they had a dog, Metta, and they have another little dog called Anapana. And so Sam, of course, his second name was Atta. Sam Atta and his partner Vi Pasana, Metta the dog, and also Anapana. They decided after lunch to have a walk up Meditation Mountain. And Sam went up there because Meditation Mountain was so peaceful, so calm. And Vi went up there because she had this wonderful Canon camera, not one of these iPhones, which you always have to, you're always asking me, oh, just I've got it the wrong way around. Well, hold on a minute, Ajahn Bhante, which button to press? A real camera. You know, the long lenses and stuff. She took that to take some insight shots because you can see forever up on top of Meditation Mountain. Metta the dog. What do dogs go up there for? They are far wiser than human beings. They just go up there for fun. For the joy of it. And Anapana went up there also because Anapana just wanted to disappear. And so they went up to to Samadhi Mountain, Meditation Mountain. And when they got even halfway up, it was so peaceful, even halfway up Meditation Mountain. Sam was just so happy, the peace there. But Sam also had a pair of eyes and could watch the view. You could see such a long distance, so his wife, Vi, she was taking all these incredible insight photos about, which exposed the nature of the world in which they lived. And Metta the dog, Metta was really wagging her tail. The further you get up Meditation Mountain, there's so much love. And she was licking her fellow dog, Anapana. And she was licking everybody and wagging her tail. She was so happy. Metta was really so happy halfway up Meditation. And Anapana, the other dog, he was beginning to fade away. You could hardly find him. Anapana became so smooth. But even the dogs could appreciate the view and the stillness. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, that was so tranquil, so still. Hardly anything moved. So Sam was there just enjoying the stillness. But he also had the eyes he could see forever on top of Meditation Mountain. Vi was collecting the photographs, but she could also experience the stillness. Met the dog. Oh, Metta was exploding in this beautiful golden light of loving kindness. You know, sometimes when the dogs are very happy, they wag their tail like it's going to fall off. That's what Metta was doing. Just incredible, powerful Metta. And as for Anapana, you couldn't find her. She disappeared. Because on the top of Meditation Mountain, peace, incredible insights, pure love, but the body and the breath are nowhere to be seen. That's what it's like at Meditation Mountain. You cannot separate Samatha Vipassana. And more importantly, you can't separate Samatha Vipassana and Metta. They all go together. So sometimes, when I teach meditation to beginners, sometimes I start with Anapanasati. If they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them how to do breath meditation. If they can't do breath meditation, I teach them Vipassana. If they can't do Vipassana, I teach them insight meditation. Then if they have trouble with that, loving kindness meditation. And if they have difficulty with that, Metta meditation, then they can't do that, letting go meditation. They can't do letting go meditation, then I teach them Anapanasati, by which time they can't remember that that's where they started off anyway. It's all the same. And I'm not saying that just flippantly. That is very true. But you know what it is? Spiritual materialism. I do Vipassana. That's much more important than Samatha. No, Samatha rocks. No, I do the fast way to meditation. Please be careful. Because when, for those traditional Buddhists, the only way to enlightenment is Eightfold Path. You can't just take little bits out. It has to be Eightfold Path. That's the way. You don't do Vipassana. You don't do Samatha. If you do anything, you just make trouble. You stop doing things. And Vipassana does you. Samatha does you. Does you in. Your ego, your sense of self, vanishes. Like Anapana. Gone. Woohoo. Good riddance.
How to go from empathy to compassion. Empathy with those that suffer makes you suffer and thus not be able to help. Thanks.
Oh, no. Instead of us and them. That's why I haven't really explained it yet. But please, or during this retreat, or even every time I visit Melbourne, please don't take any selfies. This is a Buddhist society. We don't believe in self. So you're only allowed to take weefies. We, not me, not you, but us. And that was the old story of people getting married. It's not about the bride, it's not about the groom, it's not about the other person, it's not about me, it's always about us. So empathy. Okay, nice little story. The seven monks meditating in a cave. Some of you remember this, many of you don't. I'm surprised this, how people's memory just goes so quickly. Now, seven monks met. Now listen carefully because this is interactive. I'm going to ask you a question about this. The seven monks were the head monk, the humdrum. That's, you know, the Sri Lankan way. The head monk, his brother was a monk. That's number two. The brother. The second monk was his best friend. They also ordained together. The fourth monk, enemy. They just didn't get on together. You know, you've seen that with monks and nuns. They're really good people, but sometimes that personality clashes, just like anywhere. We try to do the best, but sometimes it's, I don't know, that personality clashes. So the fourth one was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. I mean, really old. So old that we're going to die any day now. Whenever they went to do a blessing at the funeral parlour, they thought, what's the point of going home? You might as well stay there. And the next monk was a very sick monk. He was so ill, he wasn't that old, but really ill, that no one knew who was going to die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the last monk, number seven, was what we call the useless monk. He couldn't keep his robe on properly. Whenever he chanted, it was always out of key. When he meditated, he fell asleep and snored. Could never, you know, learn the chanting. Always just, you know, was there, but never could do anything really useful. He's just one of those people who just, you know, didn't have those abilities. He's a useless monk, but he was there anyway. So, seven monks in this cave in the jungle, and these band of robbers, these thieves, this gang, found that cave in the jungle. And they thought, wow, this is such a secluded, remote, hidden cave. Just, if we could take this over, we could keep all our stolen goods here, and we could hide from the police until the heat went down, until they forgot about us because somebody else was in trouble. So, we could use this as a perfect hideout for us. But there's only one problem. The monks had found it first of all. So this was really an evil, desperate band of thieves. So they decided, let's just kill all these monks, get it over and done with. They were really bad people. But the head monk, be careful of head monks. They know how to talk. They could, as they sell ice to Eskimos. They could. So anyway, he talked to the, he said, look, why do you want to kill all the monks? Because we're afraid you'll tell the police our location. But we won't tell you. Look, we're honest, we keep our promises. How do I know that? And they eventually came to a compromise. And the compromise was, the gang of thieves wanted to kill one monk in front of all the others. As a warning, this is what will happen to you if you tell the police where this cave is. And then, you know, you could go. But this is a warning to you. That was the only bargain, or if you call it a bargain, the head monk could negotiate. One of the monks would have to die so the others could survive. So, the head monk had this choice. Who would be sacrificed so the others would go free? Now imagine you were that head monk. Who would you choose before you make your decision? Let's go through the options one more time. There was the head monk. There was his brother. His brother would do anything for him. The next one was his best friend. His best friend would sacrifice their life for you. That's what a best friend is there for. They're always there for you, supporting you. The fourth monk was the enemy. He was a troublemaker. You know, people, you know, just, maybe this would be the opportunity to, you know, he could make some good karma and at the same time just leave everyone else alone. So the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was the old monk. I mean, he lived so long in this incarnation that, you know, that he was always going to die anyway soon. So, you know, just only a couple of days here, a couple of days there. Maybe the old monk was the solution. Going to die soon anyway. Or even better, the sick monk. You see, sick monks are always never going to get better, always suffering, always in pain, always needing to, you couldn't do very much. His quality of life was not so great. And so maybe the sick monk could be sacrificed. Or even better, this useless monk. The useless monk had never done any good karma in his life. Always been messing around, making mistakes, hopeless, never being able to do anything, disturbing the other monks when they were doing some chanting. Maybe the useless monk is an opportunity to make some good karma. So, of those seven monks, if you were the head monk, if you've heard the story before, read it, please shut up. If you haven't heard the story before, who do you think was chosen? So someone said the first monk, that means himself. If you agree with that, put your hand up. Come and have the courage of your convictions. Right, okay, you are all wrong. Any other suggestions? Let's go hear the old monk. Yeah, no, not the old monk, not the sick monk. Anyone for the stupid monk? Oh, you are God. You know the story, really. The answer was, he couldn't choose. No way he could choose. Because the head monk's love and regard for his best friend was no more, no less than his love for his brother. He loved even the enemy. Exactly the same as the old monk, the sick monk, even the dear old useless monk. Well, I often say this, and Ayasuki, you would know this. Every monastery has one. Some have two. So they're all useless monks. And so, and most importantly, his love for himself was no more, no less than his love for all the other monks. It was impossible. He just couldn't do it. He couldn't choose between himself and the others. His love for all was equal. And this is empathy and compassion. Why is it we sacrifice ourselves? We don't love ourselves as much as others. So we stand back, we look at everybody, just with the same caring eyes, ourselves as well. And I must say, I'm always a little bit sort of cheeky, because I remember giving this story when I was in Sacramento and there was an Episcopalian bishop, you know, came to my talk. And, you know, he was sitting down there, and I told that story especially for him. You know what? I said, well, I think we'll call him bishop. But he was Afro-American, so I couldn't really call him bro. Sorry? Your highness? Okay, well, anyway. I said, well, what do you think? And of course, he said straight away, sacrificed himself. And I was a bit cheeky. I said, that's the wrong answer. But then when I told him, the whole story said, oh, yeah, I understand that. I said, yeah, because your teacher, Jesus, didn't he say to love your neighbor as yourself? Didn't say more than yourself. Didn't say less than yourself. As yourself, no more, no less. I said, wow, that's really great. Can I use that in my sermons? Said, of course you can. Wisdom is not copyright. So, that's the answer, the empathy or compassion. You count as well. So you stand back, you put yourself in the balance as well, and others. And that means you have your answer. Okay, next question. But, I interrupt because people say, well, what happened next? And the answer is that when the head monk explained to the leader of the gang of robbers why he couldn't choose, the leader was so impressed that not only did he let the monks go, but half the monks stopped being robbers and ordained and became monks, and the other half went back to their village and got a proper job. And that is a very loose translation, interpretation of the story of Thalaputta Thera in the Theragata. Very loose. But that's what happened in that story.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, when meditating, my body tends to vibrate. Do I continue to observe this and let it continue? I thought eventually we are to let any sensation go.
Yeah, but you let it go. You don't make it go. So it's vibrating. Just go for it. You know, like, that can be really, really sort of good for exercise. And sometimes if you've got a bit of tummy on here, to vibrate that will be really, really good. So it gets in there. But yeah, go for it. Just let it vibrate. It must have been you're probably connected with your past life as a rock and roller. So anyway, yeah, just know if it's right. But when you have weird body movements, don't interrupt it, just let it happen. Because a lot of times it's, you know, your body just accommodating. Your body knows how to heal itself. You get involved and you always mess it up. Just let it go and just watch. This is very interesting. And then see what happens. But don't be afraid. Don't encourage it. Don't stop it. Just have this beautiful equanimous attitude. Oh, this is interesting. See what happens. Yes.
Okay. I meditate leaning against the back of a chair and with shoulders slumped forward. But sometimes this leads to sleepiness. I have tried holding my back and shoulders straight, but then I can't relax fully into meditation. Please advise any ideas you may have to resolve my dilemma.
Okay. Yep. So they do have a special chair. It was invented in the United States. It's called the electric chair. They're so advanced. They invented the electric toothbrush, the electric shaver, electric car, electric chair by Tesla. Now lean back and go to sleep. It's more important you go to sleep than you feel tense. So you lean back. In fact, you know, there's always some osteopaths and physiotherapists who, you know, learn meditation and teach it to some of their followers. And it's been well known that the most comfortable, healthiest position for your back is about 15 degrees from the vertical. Exactly the inclination of the backrest of your chair. That chair has like evolved. You know, for customer satisfaction, they found out that that particular angle on the back is the most comfortable and healthiest for you. That's why you fall asleep, because at last you have the chance to relax. So, I just got used to this. I'm comfortable just sitting on a cushion. But, if you want to go lean back, do so. Yeah, you go asleep at first, but after a while, you know, your sleepiness, your sleep deficit will be paid off, and then you can actually meditate very, very peacefully and happily. Of course, and this room is a little bit warm for some of us, so if, you know, you're very sleepy, just and you've got an extra blanket on, or shawl, take the shawl off, take the jacket off, take the scarf off, and then you're not so sleepy, you're more like alive. But, you know, if you're not comfortable, if you're already cold, then fine, you can keep the shawl on. But, eventually, that sort of tiredness vanishes. And then you get a nice, peaceful meditation. Yes?
When I walk, I like to make it a walking meditation. Most times I struggle to get rid of tunes in my head.
What tunes? If it is Namo Tassa Bhagavato, that's a good tune. Or Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. That's a nice tune. But when you're walking, tunes in the head. Sometimes, do you've got tunes in the head all the time? Why is it when you walk, you have tunes in the head? It's a lot of times because you've got nothing to focus on, and so you look at something, you go searching in your data bag of interesting, or rather, things to do to waste time. It's the same reason why you have music in elevators, music in airports. You just can't do anything without hearing some music somewhere. Even you go on the aircraft, you just go and sit down and there's music straight away. So there's music almost everywhere. So it's because people get afraid of silence. They don't know what to do when there's just no music at all. Because if there's no music, you're just fronting yourself and you're not really outside of your comfort zone. Oh my goodness, I have to be with me. I'm not sure if I really want to be with me. I'd rather be with Jimi Hendrix or Celine Dion or who else, I don't know. No, you don't want to be with Celine Dion. Cause I know Celine Dion simply because that when you go to funeral services, they always play the theme from Titanic. Our love will go on, or whatever it is. Isn't it bad enough losing your loved one and just thinking the ship's gone down as well and your life is ended? Crikey, people are just so depressive.
Good afternoon, Arjun. Okay, can you please advise how to have a good memory? What should we do? Thank you, Arjun.
What was the first part of that question?
That's a joke. Oh.
You know what? I've been waiting for him to play a trick on me for the last 5 days.
Yeah,
and I'm so thankful it's here, not up on stage.
So, yeah, I have a good memory. Who wants a good memory anyway? What's so great about having a great memory? I was giving a session. I got all sorts of interesting sort of conferences. This was on dementia. Alzheimer's and dementia conference. And had a sort of a doctor specialist who was presenting alongside of me. And then he started saying some of the symptoms of dementia. You know, some of the symptoms of dementia, you can't remember the past. You can't really plan for the future. And you become a little bit antisocial. You know, you like being by yourself instead of with others. I thought, oh my goodness, I've been teaching people to do that for the last 35 years. Let go of the past, don't worry about the future. And stay by yourself in solitude. So I'm one of the causes of dementia problem in Australia. But why do you need a good memory? Sometimes I always like questioning, seeing things from another angle. So, okay, remember the good things. That's really important. But why is it that when we lose our memory of the good things, we still carry on remembering the bad stuff? It's absolutely crazy. You know, what somebody said about us, what somebody did to us, they cheated us, they abused us, they hurt us. Why can't we let go of those memories? The reason is because they define who we are. That's our identity. That's our past. I remember this because, again, another conference I was giving was on grief and loss many years ago. And maybe that in Victoria, you don't, this is not as important as Western Australia. In Western Australia, about 20 years ago, there was a group of murders they called the Claremont Serial Killings. Apparently they find the guy now after 20 years. And unless they think they have, I don't think the trial's come up yet, but they're pretty sure. And anyway, at this grief and loss conference, there was a mother of one of those unsolved murder victims. And I think the body had been dug up in King's Park, but they didn't know who did it. And of course, you know, can you imagine, you being a mother, as a girl, in the prime of her life, young, going out, and she just was killed, murdered, and no one could find out why. And so this lady went to every grief and loss conference. And when I gave my presentation on how to deal with grief and loss, she got really angry. And she came up to me after the presentation, like nose to nose, breathing fire at me. And I remember what she said. How dare you presume to take away my grief? Wow. I was shocked, but thank you for showing that she was a famous griever. And she could get entry to many, many conferences and gave her some sympathy. She was important as a mother of a daughter who was killed in famous circumstances. It gave her a sense of self. And she got much sympathy from that. It gave her meaning. And from that, it opened up a lot of why people will not let go of grief and anger, revenge. Because if they let that go, they've got nothing left to define themselves. Their sense of self is gone. And they're not used to that. So that's one of the reasons why that we can't let go of the past. It's the victim identity. Be careful of that. You know, you can justify it, but you become a prisoner of it. So it's wonderful when you can let those things go. And you keep the good memories, the happy times. Every time I go to somebody's house, you see their photographs. The photographs of them on holiday in some exotic location. You see a photograph with their kids, or with their dogs, or with their, on a retreat somewhere. I always have it when they graduate from university, throwing up their caps, wearing stupid clothing, never wear again. And anyway, I've never seen yet a photograph of somebody who was sitting there doing exams. Graduating, yes. seen people on holiday. Never seen people photographed when they're caught in a traffic jam on the way to work. Seen people just on holiday, but never seen them sick in hospital, having a photograph taken with all tubes all over the place. They never put that on the wall of their house. You see people, their marriage. Oh, well, I don't know, that's past century, but I've never seen that. I'm not that old. Okay, yeah. But anyway. you always keep the good photographs. I see many people, their marriage. That's a very common, see the marriage on the wall there, your husband and your relations and stuff. Is that what you mean by having photographs with dead people? No. But you never have photographs of your divorce settlement. You don't see that on people's walls. In other words, you only have the happy photographs. You have those because that reminds you, it uplifts you. There's enough suffering in this world, so it gives you some memory that happiness is possible. And there it was, happy moments of life. Those are the memories we should keep. The bad memories, delete. So that's one of the reasons why. Why do we, can't we forget what is worth forgetting? And keep what is worth keeping. So our memory is efficient and not full of rubbish. Empty out the trash cans of your memory bank. You'll have a much happier life. Okay. I don't know if that answered the question because I can't really remember what it was.
Dear Ajahn, can you please explain merit and sharing transfer? Thank you.
Merits and sharing of merits. Merits is when you do a wonderful, good act. Like laughing at Ajahn Brahm's jokes, which makes me happy. And supporting nuns' monasteries and monks' monasteries, especially at NBM. We worked so hard for this over many years. How long have I been coming here? 35 years? I remember when I first came here, Frank was this really young man, wet behind his ears, had four head of hair, and this was, yeah. That's over 30 years, because when we had Richmond Temple, Mary Street, where was that? Where did you move from there? Because before? Yeah, it's a long time ago. But see, my memory's not that bad. But the happy times memories over there. So anyway, I remember that temple. And so we're always looking to have, instead of having to import your monks and nuns from the West, have homegrown. Homegrown, high quality, with Ajahn Brahm QC stamp on them. So that's why we decided to build NBM, Newbury Buddhist Monastery. But it is so hard to build stuff. This permission and that permission and all sorts of, as they say right now, they need to have really special sewers because it's an catchment area. But somebody else said, but look at all those cows and sheep, they're pooing all over the place. They don't need some sewers. That's going all over the ground. So anyway, we have to do all of that, so they're still hoping to get some more funds. And so this is where you make merit. It's called letting go. And research has shown conclusively that people who earn too much money, and it's only some years ago, it's for a family, it's about like maybe over 100,000 income, I think, together a year. It's really difficult. There's an optimum income. If you're earning more than that, it's just a worry, investing it, and what happens? You invest it in the banks, and they just take most of the money, they give you bad advice. I was reading that in the newspapers, all the four banks, the Big Royal Commission into just how they screw you over with your investments, they never give you good advice, so you can't trust them. But you can trust the BSV. Good investment strategy of happiness. And it's true, because Every time you give something, you're kind, and you see the results of it. That's why, you know, a few days ago, to see in Melbourne, your own BSV monastery start to take shape. Wow, it's actually happening. It's inspiring. And it's marvellous to actually to do something like that. So, that is where you can make merit. And check out the monks and nuns. Check out their accommodation. Every year, when we have our entry to Rains Day, or the Sadawas or the Katina, we have guided tours in Bodhiyana Monastery. The doors are open. You can actually go inside the monks' huts and see, you know, how they live. So check out, are there any, under the beds, any copies of Playboy? No. Any. And actually see. So, you know, my hut, my bedroom, is a tourist attraction. It's a cave. And you just got a mat on the floor, and it's hardly got anything in there. I love that. It's simple. And you know, people say, "What, you live in here, or is it just for show?" No, I live there. And we're not here, obviously. Probably today there's somebody just having a squiz and see what is in there. But I always thought, if I need to make some more funds for Bodhinyana Monastery, what I need to do, I can actually hire that out, Airbnb. At above the caves. No, it won't be any Airbnb. You know, this is like, you know, a really good monk's cave. You know, for 1 day, 2 days. It really costs you, because this is very unique. Airbnb. Would you like to go in Airbnb, live in Atambov's cave? Nice and quiet. Okay. Airbnb. But of course you have some sort of requirements there, which you have to shave your hair off and put a brown robe. But anyway, no, that's so it's nice, because I just sometimes you get really disappointed when you see like monks, they just got literally millions in their own accounts, and they just waste it in all sorts of stupid stuff. So that's why I will not be the spiritual advisor of the BSV. If you went down that path of just soliciting for them to put people's names on the board, that this kuti was built by the Live Congress. That's not how we do things. It's when you give offerings, it's expecting nothing back in return. Anonymous, you don't know who gave what. I say that what I said about that huge donation for the Nuns Monastery in Perth, which started the whole thing off, $250,000. I never seen such a big check. And sometimes I didn't know who it was. I still don't know his name. Where did he go? But anyway, that's what inspires you. So that's merit making. Now, sometimes the transfers of merits, you may have like a father or mother who's no longer here. And actually, you know this is true. You know that first book I wrote, The Opening the Door of Your Heart? That was, obviously I get royalties from that, that's sold. Been a really big bestseller. So, as a monk, I can't do anything for myself. So I said, where do you want the royalties to go? And that was actually the time we were building Dharmasala Monastery. So, that was for the hall at Dhammaloka Monastery. The next book, Good, Bad, Who Knows? Those royalties go to Dharmasala. So, they said, put it for a new hall at our centre in Perth. And I said, I'm going to dedicate those merits for my father. So all the stuff which comes from Open the Door of Your Heart, all the royalties, that's for my dad. The one who taught me opening the door of your heart. And that makes me feel so great. Because every time you get a royalty check which goes to, not never to me, but our Buddhist Society of West Australia, you think, wow, this is good karma for my dad. And you can see the connection. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have learned so much. I've had such a good start. And he deserves it. So I think, Well done, Dad. You know, I can still picture him. Still, this young man from Liverpool. Just really, I don't mind me. I'm going, it's supposed to be meditation. It's Ajahn Brahm's old memories time. But he was one who, he wasn't honest. Never taught me honesty, but certainly taught me love and sacrifice. Because I, at the age of 11 years of age, I got a place in a school soccer team. Primary school. I said, Dad, I've got a place in the school soccer team. I said, well, when are you playing? Saturday morning. I've got to work Saturday morning. I was so disappointed. You know, as a son, you got a place in the school soccer team and your dad couldn't see you play. But then, Saturday morning, there I was playing and I looked by the sideline. There was my dad cheering me on. And that just gave me so much of a boost. I asked him afterwards, how did you do that? I thought you were working today. Well, yeah, I told my boss, so I am sick, but I have to have a series of injections on Saturday mornings for the next 9 weeks. He was lying. But, you know, yeah, it was a lie, but that way he could see his son play soccer. And to me, that was forgivable. And that, of course, meant so much, the sacrifice of a father for son.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
I think that's particularly poignant when you were talking about him the other night.
Yeah.
And about his childhood has happened to him. So he really did learn how to accept, forgive and learn, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And just the sort of stuff which you remember. We always remember our fathers. And if you've got a good one, oh, they're just like such a mentor. And it's also that's why it's lovely to give merit to somebody like that. And my mum as well, my grandma, grandfather, all the people you've known and loved. So it feels wonderful. So when you do something, you give some good karma. It's not just for you, it's for them. And even if your mother, you know, was a really, really devout Christian, you don't make merit by giving it to the Buddhist society. Give it to the church. What would make them happy? What would they would really love you to do? And say, Mum, you know, that church always said was too cold. I sponsored heating for it. And so that's for you, Mum. So it's not for you. It's for the person who passed away. So that's what I like. That's a sharing of merit. It's very beautiful.
Just one last question.
Is there such a thing as a last question?
Yeah. There's just one here. Well, now anyway.
Okay.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, I always do my best to be a kind and honourable human being. However, sometimes I feel like I'm being psychologically attacked by a family member. How do I manage this? Thank you.
Oh, it's easy. Learn the evil eye. No, you don't learn the evil eye. Psychologically attacked by a family member. They just learn your buttons and they try and press them, try and have no buttons. Okay, one of the stories. This was not a family member, but I was with my mum visiting and she was making my lunch. And lunches were very important for monks, especially when I was very thin many years ago. Actually, I was thin, you know. I got photographs to prove it. So... there was the doorbell rang. So I said, Mum, don't spoil my lunch. I'll answer it for you. It wasn't really compassion for my mum. It was like compassion for my tummy. So I don't want you to be disturbed and spoil my lunch. So I went to the door, opened it, and there was this lady selling knickknacks door to door. And if you come from sort of England, it was called like the Romani community, the gypsies they used to call them. They said, do you want to buy this little sprig of heather? I said, no, thank you very much. I was very polite. And then she looked at me and said, if you don't buy this sprig of heather, I'll put a gypsy curse on you. She said that to me. And that was their marketing technique. But they didn't realize who they were dealing with because I was a senior Buddhist monk. I was in my robe and I really stood tall and I said to her, don't you realize I am a fully ordained Buddhist monk of many, many years, good meditation teacher, my curses are far stronger than yours. That's what I said to her. I don't know, I still really don't know whether I should have done that or not. But it certainly worked. Her face dropped, she looked so frightened. She turned around and ran away. Of course, you don't have any curses. You know, if you did have them, you wouldn't curse anybody anyway. So, but she didn't know that. It taught her a little lesson. You shouldn't threaten to curse anybody, use psychological pressure on anybody. And anyway, you can be much stronger. So if you learn about meditation, learn about your mind, learn about yourself, it's just so people can't have psychological pressure on you. Because psychological pressure on what? So after a while, it's just, you have your fears, things you haven't admitted yet. Just admit, you know, what you are, done any small things which are wrong. And so they can't sort of blackmail you, physically, psychologically, or whatever. So anyway, that's it, is it? Okay, we've got some questions over here, but they're in the so we should like to do some meditation. Oh, we've got 50 minutes we've gone, so let's have a break. And then we do some meditation afterwards, maybe end with some questions. Okay, now is the time to have a break. 15 minutes is all you get. Precisely at 2:05, we will take off into another deep meditation. Let's see what the office does. Oh. Okay. Okay, this is one. Yeah, okay, do this one. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, these are good ones. Thank you.
to me. It is what Ajahn Chah was saying, my man, he's not doing that good. I don't know where he heard that from. I don't even want to stop you from sitting there. But now he's only asking. How can he stop you? Q&A session always right. On this Sunday, you have Tyson Carver.
I don't know. to listen to my favorite music, to have a lot of learning.
Okay, could everyone settle down because we'll be starting again soon. Thank you.
So here we go. Nice meditation. What? Hot. Oh yes, I'm a very hot monk. That's why people like to take photographs of me. I'm a I'm feeling warm. I am warm with the fire of the Dhamma, with kindness and compassion. No, I'm fine. She'll be right. So here we go. Deep meditation. Chilling out. So just be aware of your body first of all. Just sitting here. Just making peace, being kind, being gentle. First of all, with your body. I look upon my body like a vehicle, like a car. Mine is a vintage car. And you have to look after it. Make sure it's well serviced. And for me to service my car, I just learn how to relax everything. Starting with my legs. Sitting here for a couple of hours, or maybe an hour and a half or something. Just make sure they're as comfortable as possible. They'll never be perfect. But just a bit of kindness, compassion, care towards them makes them feel so much better. Just like if ever you're a doctor or a nurse, you visit people in hospital, just the fact that you care. You go around and just talk to people. Just that makes such a difference. The same with my own parts of my body. I felt that I care for my legs, I don't take them for granted. Means that my legs tell me what they need. So I've just adjusted them. Thank you, say the legs. That feels better. And then my butt. Sometimes I like a real high cushion under it, sometimes not. Now it just feels okay. Get my back all nice and stretched. It's not doing that, just stretching, just like a dog. I wasn't a dog in my past life, but I know that some Zen monk once told me that if you write a book, you have to spend the next 7 lifetimes as a donkey. So I think I've got, how many donkey lives have I got left? Almost about 70, I think. It's okay, I know how to catch carrots. So I stretch my back, move it around, get it nice and comfy. My hands, put them in a nice place. shoulders relax to the max. Yeah, I can feel those muscles in my shoulders, a little bit tense. You know them. You know just how to relax them. When I relax them, it's this thing which the word let go describes. Letting go is just the word. It describes this, the attitude of my mind. This little switch which I turn on, and all the muscles get released. Not squashed, not pulled, not stretched. Let go. After a while, you understand what that word means. You learn on your own body what letting go is. It's that little command, if you call it command, but it's really a turning off tension, which your mindfulness gives you the feedback that things get loose, not pulled tight anymore. And then my neck. Neck is really good, it's not irritating because the irritation has gone up to my nose. And then your face, your head. Make sure it's all nice and relaxed as much as possible. Feel the whole body. And if there is one part which is more disturbing than others, focus on it. Get to know it, get to understand it. Know yourself, know your disease. 100 illnesses faced, 100 illnesses cured. Adapted from the Chinese art of war. And once the body is relaxed, go to your peaceometer. Just like your body is stretched, sometimes it's wounded. Sometimes your body can be sick. That causes the stress, the inflammation, the pain. So similar with your mind. You've been wounded, injured, not healed yet. Or maybe this moment, disappointed. These are all stresses of the mind. And we learn how to relax to the max in our mind. Disengaging from your past. Disentangling from fears of the future. You feel your peaceometer start to move closer to peace. And peace is cool. Peace is joyful. Peace is where you can rest. Peace is where you don't have to change yourself and blame yourself. Peace is where you feel there's no faults in you. You're a tree in the forest, you belong. As you are, you make peace with your past. You make peace with your future. You make peace with your moment called now. Just being here. Your peaceometer. Down, down, down. Once you're peaceful, you can be aware of your breath or aware of whatever's there right in front of your mind right now. Almost like you're a passenger on Buddha air. You can't tell the captain to go fast, go this way or that way. You're taking your seat, sitting quietly, and just enjoying the insight entertainment system. Not in-flight entertainment, insight entertainment. Seeing where this meditation leads. Making peace. Being kind, being gentle. This moment, whatever it is, most important in the whole world. Be with it. Let it be. It's not the sound that disturbs you. It's you who sometimes disturb the sound. If the mind wanders off, why? Because you've been too hard on it, too demanding. Be more loving to your mind, more kind, treating your mind like a friend, someone you love hanging out with, not someone you tell what to do. Making peace, being kind, being gentle, turns whatever you're experiencing in this moment into a friend. Which means you're just here, enjoying the moments. I will now be quiet. Another 20 minutes, 25 minutes, then I will start speaking again. getting close to the end of the meditation again. How are you feeling? What worked and what didn't work? In meditation we understand the causes which lead to peace, comfort, relaxation. Once we understand those causes, we focus on those causes, then peace comes. I will now ring the gong 3 times. We did have a couple of questions in the put in the bell. So we'll just have a look at those first and then we can do our concluding comments.
Dear Ajahn Brown, I used to think meditation as a repetition of some words or sentences. Is it a different kind of meditation, or is it unnecessary? Thank you.
Okay. Repetition of words or sentences can be a useful tool. It can be as part of the meditation. We call these mantras. So in the Thai tradition, the forest tradition, we used to do the mantra Buddho, Buddho with the breath. Breathing in, say Bud, breathing out, To, Buddho, Buddho. That meant a lot to people brought up in that culture. When I started teaching that in Australia, it didn't work that much. So I tried another method. So when you breathe in, you say to yourself, shut. You breathe out, up. Shut, up. Shut. It worked for a while, but people started laughing. So that didn't help. So that's why I did the breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. That seemed to be what I settled on. But that's only for a part of the meditation, because after a while you don't need to say the words anymore. So in a different levels of meditation, not levels in the sense of you're trying to sort of get to the next level, like in a computer game. It's just as you develop meditation, you get more refined. So you start by watching your body, then maybe piezometer, then watching your breath. But then, just like the different vehicles you used to get here, I went in an aircraft to get to Melbourne Airport, then a car to get here, and then got out of the car and walked with my shoes on to get to the monks' quarters, then took my shoes off to walk barefoot to go the rest of the way. Different vehicles for different parts of the journey. Unfortunately, I couldn't land the aircraft in the car park of the Buddhist Society of Victoria. Unfortunately, they had a big tent in there. So the point is, different parts of meditation, different tools for different stages. So where we do the watching, sort of the what's it called? Saying mantras. That's where it's different. A certain part of the meditation. You're doing the mantras, whatever it is. Say Buddho, Buddho. When the mind gets peaceful, you don't need the words anymore. You can't park the car in your room in the monks' quarters. You have to leave it outside. It can only go so far. So you start with, say, a mantra, then mantra disappears. You're just with the breath, breathing in, breathing out. And the breath can take you so far. And then you get nimittas, beautiful lights. When you have a light in the mind, you don't need the breath anymore. It's done its job. Now you just have this beautiful light in the mind. And then you use the light as far as it can take you to the entrance of the jhanas, and then you're in the jhana realm. So every one of these little vehicles has a usage. And there comes a time when you have to let go of that vehicle. You know, this is very similar to the Buddha's simile of the raft. Only the Buddha just mentioned the raft is to go across one stretch of water. You use the raft to go across, but once you go across to reach the other side, you don't take the raft with you. You have to go by foot when you go to the other side. So every vehicle has its usage, has its time. Even breath meditation, the breath can only take you so far. You let the breath go, and you get on the next vehicle. That's the way this meditation works. Okay.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have heard you mentioning that in deep meditation, EEC or ECG could become flat. This, I believe, can be interpreted as there is no blood flow. When someone travels for long hours in a plane without moving, it is said that the possibilities of having deep vein thrombosis are very high. In deep meditation, there is no movement of the physical body. So shouldn't this be a concern? Would you like to comment on this?
No, don't get worried about those things. Because what happens is, in deep meditation, there's no... Even Ajahn Chah's story. That when Ajahn Chah had his stroke and couldn't speak, he was still meditating. We know that because sometimes you stop breathing. And for a long time, hours, he didn't die. Because on one occasion, the doctor was really scared, or rather the nurse, male nurse on duty, was really scared. He's not breathing. And the monk said, oh, he does it all the time, just leave him alone. And so the doctor was arguing, and the male nurse was arguing, and so they decided to take blood samples every few minutes to make sure the blood was well oxygenated. Because it didn't matter, as long as there's oxygen in the blood, it didn't matter whether you're breathing or not. And they found all this time when Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing, still his oxygen levels in his blood remained constant. I wish that would have been reported and, done under some sort of conditions that would actually prove that this was not a fake. He wasn't breathing. But still, blood was going, heart was still going. But in the deeper meditations, even there, the heart stops. There's no thing going through. It's really weird. But you're not dead. And apparently, there's some Hindu yogis have done that under laboratory conditions. And sometimes that we wonder, that's impossible. But that is the arrogance of science, thinking that they know and things which they can't make any sense of cannot exist. As I said, it's the same thing with when you have the flower pot experiment, which I mentioned a few days ago. When that lifts from the table, the scientists in the Imperial College London, they thought that this can't be happening. It's not true. It was true. Even some of the other things which Emeritus Professor Bernard Carr, a very close student to Professor Stephen Hawking's great friend, Buddhist, first Buddhist I ever met, also a theoretical physicist and also a member of the Psychic Research Society. Just in conversations with him, he said he's taken these professors, top experimenters, great scientists, to mediums. Who could do the lifting the tables? This was not a trick. The table's lifting up the air. And the scientist was free, having a look underneath, checking everything, seeing how can this be happening? And I remember him telling me, this scientist turned to him and said, this can't be happening. This can't be happening. This is some sort of, I'm being deluded, I'm being drugged or something. And anything but admit the evidence right before their eyes. So when you get a doctor saying, this person, the brain is not functioning. There's no blood flow. But nothing is happening. They're still alive. They come out afterwards without any damage whatsoever. Weird but true. This is one of the things why I liked science, the interaction between real science and meditation. Because real science, even if you can't understand what's happening, the evidence has to take priority. little things like quantum entanglement. You know, you've heard that word. It's true. They've tested it out. It's a phenomena which is real, but no one understands what the heck's going on or why it works. Just like some of these other things in meditation. Why? According to our understanding, it shouldn't happen, but it does. Which means that our understanding needs to be changed rather than the evidence canned. One of those little phenomena which I love bringing up at this junction was Professor John Lauber. In 1981, a long time ago, Sheffield University, his field of research was the shape of human skulls and whether that affected one's health and longevity and social interaction. So whenever he saw anyone on campus who had a slightly deformed skull, he would invite them on the program. He saw this young graduate student in mathematics, and he's perfectly socially normal, girlfriend, ordinary guy, only his skull shape was slightly out of the ordinary. And gave him a CT scan, and the CT scan showed he had no brain. It's just the cerebral fluid in there, intracranial fluid. That was all. And I think 1%, just a sheaf of cortex on the outside. No amygdala, no other, just whatever. No way in the world should he be alive, let alone be a genius at mathematics with a girlfriend, emotionally stable. And Professor Lauber just wrote this article, The Boy with No Brain. It wasn't a mistake of the machines, they did it a couple of times, but it was just too difficult to accept. So it was just put in anomaly. Couldn't have happened, but it did happen. The boy with no brain. A no-brainer. But it was actually there. You know, I got the article back over in Bodhidharma Monastery, and just that challenges. It shouldn't happen, but it does. So those are the sorts of things I really love, what meditation does, gets in all this information. So anyway, that's what happens. So, yeah, the brain is dead. No ECG. Heart's not pumping. But, fully conscious. And you're very safe also, because even in the suttas, teaching the Buddha, there was this monk, and he was meditating in the jungle, and his two villagers were going hunting for mushrooms or something, and they saw this monk sitting perfectly still in the jungle, really still, and they thought he's dead. They checked, no breath, no pulse. So what can you do with, you know, you're a Buddhist, you just respect the Sangha, you see a monk there dead, what should we do now? I think, well, you know, just if we leave him, he'll get eaten by the animals. That's not respectful. You can't take him back to the monastery, it's too far, so let's cremate him here. So, you know, in the forest, you've got wood everywhere, so they got some wood, only took it half an hour, and they put the monk on top of the wood, they did some sort of chanting, whatever they could remember, lit the wood, and then, once the fire was going, monk on top, so, you know, fire would do the rest, they're busy people. So they left, and the following morning, they were really impressed when that monk walked into the village for alms food. Not even his robe was burnt. So that's what happens. So if it does happen that maybe Ayasuki gets into a deep meditation, thinks she's dead, and you take her to the local crematorium, put her in a box, they put her in there and turn on the gas and it gets really hot, and then what would happen afterwards? Once they sort of opened up the oven to get the ashes out, hi, me again! She'd still be okay with her robe, everything. Weird, but true. Anyway, I'm going for a long time with those sorts of stories, and I'm supposed to be finishing in a couple of minutes, so quick.
Yeah, one more. When the fifth sense disappears, the mind is not connected to the body. Is that why the person you mentioned didn't know what happened to his body in the ambulance and in the hospital?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. He wasn't aware of his body. He was just in a beautiful realm of the mind. I asked him, he said, the most wonderful experience of his life. Were you unconscious? No, really conscious, fully aware. Blissed out in a deep meditation. That's what happens. So the five senses can't reach you. But the amazing thing is you're perfectly safe. You can't be harmed. Anyway, there we go.
Do you want to say any more or will I thank you?
That's enough for now. One of my favourite words is discombobulated. And I think you've been discombobulated enough, which means totally confused, astounded, amazed, I hope. But these things are true.
However, I still will thank you formally. So on behalf of the whole of the BSV community, thank you, Ajahn, so much for coming with, for being with us for the last 4 days.
Well, I didn't have anything else to do, so.
For showing us the AFL way, for sharing how to be kind to our bodies, the simile of putting down the cup and stillness, how to let go and how to get lost. And I guess most of all for your energized self and for your sense of fun and disrespect and all the other things that people come back each year to that's why we get so many people coming back to listen to you and to be with you each year. So we'll look forward to seeing you at some time next year.
Yeah, okay, yeah, great. Catch up with you, mate.
Yep. And just thank you, everybody, for coming. And if you wouldn't mind taking a black garbage bag home with you, that would be good.
Yep.
Thank you.
Don't forget to support NBM Monastery. So there's a place to go to when I come back.
Yes, nice well, but when you come back...
Well, yeah. If you haven't started,
you won't
maybe
come
I
back.
Won't come back.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a good place to...
This time next year, well...
Who knows?
Who knows?
Yes.
Who knows?
Yes. Anyway, my nose knows.
So, so three sadhus?
Yeah, three sadhus. Sadhu. Sadhu! And the biggest one ever? Sadhu! Okay, have a wonderful life.
Yeah. So I'd just like everyone to just stay seated while Ajahn leaves. And also I wanted to say very much, Ayasukhi, thank you so much for your presence as well. It's just wonderful having a nun on the platform. I mean, I'll get quite emotional, so I won't say any more.
Very good. Okay. Excellent. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Oh.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Oh, no, that's your envelope. I've got yours, is it? No, it's just the instructions.